Hello there. Before we get going, we advise listener discretion for Justice Disrupted. This podcast discusses social justice and will touch on many areas, including but not exclusive to crime, trauma and abuse in all their various forms. Some listeners may find such content distressing. In this episode, specific topics include sexual grooming, drugs and porn addiction. If you are affected by anything in this podcast, there's a list of websites on the Community Justice Scotland website from which you can seek support and or guidance. Thanks loads for joining us. Shall we get started? Welcome, welcome one and all. On this episode of Justice Disrupted, I chat to a very thoughtful Scottish working class writer about the issues he explores in his memoir, Euphoric Recall, which you can order now from his website or pick up wherever you buy your books. There's a little bit of what people in Tellyland bizarrely call strong language in this episode, so if that kind of thing bothers you, I don't know, steel yourself. Do some press-ups and have a stern word with yourself in front of a mirror. I'm sure you can handle it. I'm not going to bang on too much here because Aidan is a very thoughtful and eloquent speaker. And I believe, well I hope, that you'll find this a very interesting and edifying chat. Thanks Bundles for choosing to listen to us in what is becoming an ever more densely populated ocean of podcasts. You get all this for free. And if you'd like us to continue having what I believe are quite important conversations, then give us a like on whatever platform you listen to us on. Better still, give us a comment, a share, tell a mate. You know how all this stuff works. Ah, that's enough waffle from me. Let's get cracking. Aidan Martin, thanks so much for talking to me. I read your book and it was very relatable to me.
Yeah.
Can you tell me a bit about where you grew up and what the general vibe was?
So I grew up in an area called Ladywell in the town of Livingston. I was born in 1986. Livingston was a new town in between Glasgow and Edinburgh to deal with the overspill of Glasgow. So there wasn't a lot here. Today, you will see a big shopping centre, a football team, lots of restaurants. There wasn't any of that stuff, you know. And I was born into, I would say, a lad culture, certainly when I was, you know, growing up. The school I went to was bottom of the league tables for educational attainment, violence, behaviour, all that stuff. It was a mixture because some of it was brilliant, you know. We had a lot of social community. People knew each other in first name terms. We had, you know, gala days. Because it was a new town, a lot of the people that moved there could pick where they wanted to live. So you had a lot of family members living close to each other, grandparents, aunties and uncles, cousins. So those things were amazing. It was before social media, so kids played outside, we played football, we built goals, we had a childhood. But the older I got, the more it became about the violence, being territorial, tribalism, you know, substance abuse. It was rife with mental health issues before terminology like mental health and trauma and addiction was ever used. For lads like me, we all had to look the same. We all had to behave the same. We all had to have a French crop and a gold hoop in the ear and wear the tracksuit top and bottoms and the Rockport boots and have a chain and, you know, speak the same way and think the same way. And it was very uniformed. And we all grew up with the wrong rules, you know. So as much as there were some beautiful things about growing up working class, there was a lot of harsh realities and there was social deprivation as a part of that reality.
One of the questions that's leveled at me a lot is like, you're a smart kid. How did you end up getting into so much trouble? Can you take a bit of the pressure off me for once and explain how that happens?
Yeah, because there was nothing else. There was no other outlets. There was no creative outlets back then. Like if I'd have said back then I wanted to be a writer, or an author, or my best friend on my front cover as well, and he's a painter and a musician. If we'd have said those things back then, you'd get beat up for it. There was no concept of being better. We grew up with an inferiority complex. No one improved themselves. No one thought anything grand. Where I came from, no one talked about college or uni or that. It was kind of like you knew you were leaving school without qualifications. You knew you were going straight into a factory job. There was no hope or aspiration. It was quite a hopeless, powerless feeling. And so the thing I always say is, it's not why would you turn into an addict or why would you end up in a life of violence or crime. It's why wouldn't you when you grow up in that kind of environment. You know, there's a term called self-fulfilling prophecy, and a lot of us, you know, were self-fulfilling prophecies. We grew up to be the kind of people we were expected to be. There was no hopes or dreams or aspirations for us where we came from.
Those environments are very insular. They're like microcosms that are logistically, culturally, economically isolated from the rest of society. And it doesn't matter how intelligent you are or how creative you are, you're still framing your universe based on the data and input that you get from that world. So like when I started taking drugs, I was a smart kid and I was a creative kid, but I was still very much a council estate kid, a scheme kid. And so like when I started taking drugs, I knew Tim Leary was, I knew all these kind of psychedelic explorers was. So it was very easy for me to build a little persona within the shell of my external persona. And I think that's a thing that a lot of lads through necessity on council estates do, is have like almost an internal world and an external projection. Can you relate to that? Was that an experience that you felt?
Yeah, I mean, we were terrified to be different. Do you know, I mean, I give an example of being in high school, and at the time, me and my best friend were given braces for our teeth through the NHS, and we didn't wear them because you would get beat up at school for wearing them. So we broke our braces, and our mums just stopped trying to get us to wear them. And so we had squint teeth, in which we had to pay thousands in adulthood to get fixed. And that is a very, very early lesson in life that you cannot be different. You have to be within this pack mentality. It was a very small world. We didn't even have the knowledge to think out with that. Yeah, I can certainly identify what you're saying with. I describe it now as a very bizarre way to grow up, but it was kind of all we knew at that time.
I'm a decade older than you, but I think things only really started to change, and I'm not even sure how much they've changed on estates like we grew up on. Relatively recently, there was really nothing. You know, there might have been a rusty old swing set somewhere that was probably vandalized, but all we had was the community of our friends, I guess, and that's both a great thing and also a terrible thing. So what kind of kid were you? What kind of student were you? What would your teachers say about you?
So this is the thing, right? I loved writing, right? I loved writing poetry. Now, that to me was an outlet for a lot of feelings, but I didn't realize I was nurturing a talent. Now, nobody in my school recognized that I liked writing. Yeah, I was more commonly, like a lot of kids in my high school, told the kind of jobs we weren't going to get. So I wasn't engaging in classes. Now, looking back, a lot of kids didn't engage because of the environment. It wasn't because they lacked talent or ability, but we weren't nurtured. As far as when it went really sideways, I would say leaving high school and realizing, you know, without actually being able to articulate at the time, realizing that I had no future, that there was nothing to aspire to, that you've already got mental health issues and you've already got addiction issues and you're going headfirst into that lifestyle. I mean, I went to become a sales assistant in the shop that I used to be a paper boy in on minimum wage. And there's no shame in working as a sales assistant, but I didn't believe that I could do anything more with my life, and I wasn't earning a great deal of money and there was no social mobility for me. And then everyone in my environment and my culture was the same, and drug use was rife. And so it was such a social norm that if you were one of the ones who wasn't participating, then you were excluded and you were the outcast.
I got expelled when I was around 15, but before that happened, there used to be a thing called work experience where they'd send you away for 2 weeks to like focus on a job that you might be interested in a career in. And I remember going to the interview and saying, oh, I'm interested in a career in the arts. And he literally laughed in my face. Like he laughed at me. Wow. and sent me to a building site. Incrementally, those kind of things happen throughout our lives when we grow up in that environment, don't they? And they can chip away at our sense of self, our self-esteem. They project onto us what we're supposed to be. I was also told by teachers that I would end up as a drug addict and a criminal. They were right. But it's that self-fulfilling prophecy kind of thing, isn't it?
Well, it is, because I talk about in my book how when I started college, and I was at entry level at college, I was a broken human being still, and there was a lecturer that says to me, Aidan, you're going to go far, I can feel it in my bones, and she meant it when she said it. And what she did was she projected that belief into me. Now, if that kind of attitude had been there from the very beginning, then a lot of kids might have been nurtured differently to realise the talents, because I think a lot of the talents we have are already within us. They're just waiting to be realised and nurtured. And I wish I'd have discovered the writing sooner. I wish at high school someone was like, you know what, you're great at this. You can be an author. But nobody would have ever said that.
One of the biggest failings that we have culturally or as a society is the lack of nurture. In environments that have been stressful for generations because of poverty and have been isolated in that stress, they've been dominated by a certain kind of aggressive culture, generally that has been born of prison culture and that's been reflected back into these communities that feed prisons and then are fed back to. Mm-hmm. I feel that there is a lack of nurturing that happens, and that is fundamentally the most destructive thing about growing up in those environments. There's economics and there's a lack of opportunity, but being poorly nurtured and not through anybody's fault is incredibly destructive and keeps people within a limited space.
Yeah, I agree 100%. Lads were killing each other where I grew up, and it's because we all thought we were enemies of each other, and we thought that because, again, none of us were nurtured to develop our own individual and collective identities. And we tore each other down rather than bigged each other up because we thought that's what we were supposed to do. It was territorial. Had there been a culture of nurture, perhaps we would have looked at each other as, you know, someone that can help each other develop in life rather than looking at someone and going, that person's a threat to me, and then feeling that way for years and years. And then you see people that are institutionalized and never get out of that cycle of thinking.
Can I talk trajectory of drugs with you?
Sure.
You know, I see myself as a primary school kid, as a good kid, as a well-behaved kid. I didn't want to, you know, I didn't want to do anything to upset my mum. You know, I didn't want to misbehave. Still, I was 11 when I started doing solvents because they're free, they're shopliftable. Yeah. Then I guess booze and weed came next. Mushrooms, because they're also free. Magic mushrooms, when I was around sort of maybe 13, LSD. And then it goes sort of rave culture with all the rave culture drugs and then harder drugs. Mm-hmm. What was your trajectory?
So it's funny because we talk about obviously drugs, but my first drug was hardcore porn. And yeah, it was discovering it accidentally at the age of 10. And it was at the extreme end of hardcore, within the boundaries of what's legal porn. And looking back, I can see I was using it to change how I felt. I was trying to get a high out of it. As far as substance, it was certainly alcohol. And then we had a friend whose dad owned a corner shop, and the friend would come in. Now, I don't know if the dad was sending the friend in or the friend was nicking it and coming in with it, but he was bringing it to drama class, and it was half bottles of whiskey, half bottles of vodka, and we were buying them. And if we could get Alcopops and stuff, we would do it. Like, we were 14, 13, 14. We were meeting up outside in a place called Cedar Bank in Ladywell. And it was this meeting point. And we'd meet up and we'd huddle up on a Friday night. And we're down in straight whiskey and straight vodka. And from a very, very young age, you're taking extreme spirits. And then it's like yourself, it moved on. Weed became the next thing. I never liked weed, but everyone was doing it. And I liked being out my own head. And then ecstasy was the next, you know, Eckies came along, speed, bass, all the different versions of that drug. And then for me, it was discovering cocaine. You know, I was about 18 or 19. And when I discovered cocaine, the way I describe it was like I fell in love. You know, that was the drug I married myself to. I know there are people, like friends of mine, that went beyond that. They end up getting into opiate-based drugs, and whether it's prescription or heroin or street versions. But for me, cocaine was where I found myself, and after all these years in addiction and then recovery, I realized that, you know, my consequences were the same, my root causes were the same. So I learned that the drug of choice isn't really what addiction is, but certainly cocaine was the drug for me, more than anything else.
It's a complicated thing, addiction. By the way, I had a very similar experience with porn around the same age, and I think it's a very, very common story for young men. It's now more prevalent than ever. Mm-hmm. I mean, it'd almost be impossible to reach adulthood or to reach puberty even without having seen pornography. So have you got any thoughts about how we interrupt that?
I don't know. I think it's almost impossible to stop it now.
Yeah.
It's a click away, whereas it was almost more difficult for me to have developed that back then than it would be now. Back then, tapes and magazines were quite common. You know, everyone's uncle had porn mags, everyone's dad had porn mags and tapes. But today, you don't even need to be stealing them off a family member. You've got access to technology wherever you are. Don't even need to be in your own house to access it. So I don't know if there's a way to interrupt it. Perhaps it's more about education on the impacts of how that can desensitize someone's ideas of intimacy and sex and what that means.
I think really that's all we can do, isn't it? And that's all we can do with most addictions. And it's all about formative education and understanding why certain behaviors happen and why we're compelled to do certain things. Mm-hmm. You said that you didn't like weed. Neither did I, actually. But I smoked a lot of it as a young teenager because I thought that's what I was supposed to do. I've been collecting mental health diagnoses like Pokemon since I was 11, you know. That didn't help. I took psychedelic and I smoked weed, even though I knew I could feel the deleterious effect it was having on me. My true love, when I found the drug for me, other than ecstasy maybe, which was a different thing altogether, was opiates and opioids, barbiturates originally, again, because I could get them for free off the doctor at the time. It was a simpler time. And and the reason for that is my brain is very busy. It's very active and I'm very neurotic. And I've got all these other diagnoses like ADHD and autism that I'm only finding out about as an adult. Opiates just calmed all of that. I was self-medicating.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk a little bit about your experience around drugs in terms of like what you thought you were doing and in retrospect what you believe you were doing?
Yeah, it's probably easier to start with retrospect because I can see retrospectively that I had no self-esteem and no self-worth and no sense of purpose or identity or direction. I had a lot of trauma, was suffering badly with mental health, everything from depression, anxiety, body dysmorphia. I was 100% self-medicating, but I was part of a culture of people who were all doing it. You know, in the beginning, it was exciting and it was a buzz and it was fun. And that disguised the other sort of downsides or potential reasons for using it. The consequences started to pile up. But again, it was so normalized in that society. And then I didn't know I was an addict, you know. And there's a saying in the recovery scene, I didn't know I didn't know. So I didn't know I was an addict. And I didn't know that I didn't know I was an addict. Do you know what I mean? There was many layers to not having a clue as to what was wrong. I didn't know, and if we didn't use terms like trauma or mental health or addiction, and certainly men didn't express their feelings. At the time, for a long time, I thought I was having a good time until it got really sore, and then I started thinking I was just crazy. I remember thinking for a while that it was just me. There'd be times I was making faces at myself in the mirror and not knowing what was wrong with me and thinking my mind had just slipped. Looking back, it's much easier to join the dots up. You know, I've had a lot of therapy, I've been in the recovery scene for a while, I've had education about psychological and sociological reasons for what happens in society and that Scotland has a really unique problem with drugs, but I didn't know any of that stuff then.
For lads as well, I'm speaking from my personal experience here, but you tell me if it's relatable. We value recklessness, or we celebrate recklessness, working class or underclass or whatever you want to call us boys. I was a skinny lad. I did my best, but I wasn't great at fighting. I just didn't have the scale to fight some of the lads. And so the only other option I had was self-destruction through drugs. I mean, it sounds insane to anybody outside of that culture, but that is like value. If I hospitalized myself through drug taking, which I did frequently, it wasn't frowned upon in my community of friends. It was lauded. Well, all we have is our physical selves, right? We either have power and dominance over other people, or we have a capacity to show that we don't give a fuck. And that's what I had. I had the latter. What do you think that's about? And was it the same on your scheme?
No, 100%. It's a substitute for I can't get positive attention, so I'll get negative attention. You know, I was never brave enough to be a drug dealer or to commit serious crimes to keep my substance use going. But me and my friend Colin, who I can name because he gave consent for his name to be in the book, we lived together for 3 years. We were well known for having party houses. Now, the houses were a shit tip, but we were well known for that's the place you go for a wild party. And it gave us a sense of status and a sense of worth. And we mattered in some kind of way within that community because we had this drug using pad. I agree as well. I think that everything's about instant gratification. So it takes a long time and a lot of hard work and effort to get to a place where you can achieve anything in life. And a lot of us growing up felt like we could never achieve things. So you can get instant gratification through the drug use, but doing negative things, like you say, you're like, oh, one of the lads, one of the boys, oh, he's fucking mental, that guy. And it gives you a sense of status amongst your peers, and it feeds into self-worth. It's not a healthy self-worth, but it's your version of self-worth. That's my thought on it.
What has your recovery journey been like?
I couldn't have predicted it. Let's just put it that way. It's not been straightforward. It has included a lot of relapsing and a lot of lapsing, but then the later part of it has been much more steady. Like, for example, for the last 3 and a bit years, I've not touched a substance and I'm in a much healthier, calm, stable place. Recovery for me is made up of many different pillars. There's a recovery fellowship, which is something that's personal to me. It's not everyone's idea of recovery, but education was huge, a huge part, because I learned about myself and I learned about society. A big part of addiction for me is guilt and shame, because I've done a lot of selfish things and hurt a lot of people. Now, I think there are two sides to addiction. There's a selfish part of it where I've done things wrong, but there's the part where society has also failed me and set me up for that failure. So recovery taught me more about me and my side of things, and education taught me about society and how society has played its role. And volunteering as well, because I had no real skill sets. I couldn't really see where my life was going, so I started to volunteer. Volunteering gave me self-worth and self-respect, because it was a selfless act, and gave me positive connections and set me up for future stuff, which I've gone on to do in my life. So yeah, recovery is made up of a lot of different things, and I think it's unique to the individual, because I used to think that abstinence-based recovery was the only, you know, you had to go straight from drug use into abstinence. I've come to learn in my education and my activism that harm reduction is a very important part of someone's journey. So you continuously learn about what recovery means to different people.
Could anything have been done at a more formative stage to intervene or interrupt the behaviours that led to addiction?
Yeah, 100%. We could have had a high school that was better tooled to educate us and to catch people in the net, you know, if people were struggling. It wasn't set up for that at all. When I sought out help, it was a GP and then a third sector organisation. There were no state-funded facilities. You know, in West Lothian, where I'm from, we have no rehab. We have no detox facility. We have no recovery houses. And that's in 2021, we're talking about this. So when I was coming about, as far as recovery meetings as well, which are just self-supporting, there was only two of those. It was unheard of. I didn't really have any knowledge about what was wrong with me, and there was nothing there to intervene to get help with. What people need is quick access to mental health services, therapeutic services, harm reduction facilities, abstinence-based recovery, rehabs, detoxes. We need to deal with the problem, and then we need to put prevention methods in place so that we don't have the problem again. You know, I think you can look at the Portuguese model as being a good blueprint for that.
How many addicts do you meet that haven't experienced a degree of trauma?
Oh, yeah.
I believe that education around those things should start formatively.
Yes.
That at school, at primary school even, that we understand that if we experience a thing and we don't process it in a emotionally healthy way, then we're probably going to have some negative outcomes as an adult. I mean, we know this. It's not fluffy. It's science. Mm-hmm. It seems that we'd not just save a lot of people a lot of difficulties, but also it makes economic sense. And I don't really understand why that kind of education isn't more prevalent.
Me as well. I mean, I believe it makes economic sense to keep people out of prisons and put them into rehabs if they need it. I believe it's economically viable to give people treatment early in their life so that they can become more productive in later life, but we don't seem to invest that way.
What are your thoughts about the various services that are available to drug users at the moment, and how have they changed since you were interacting with them?
I think we're so far behind where we need to be that it's frightening. UK-wide, it's a problem, but obviously in Scotland, yeah. In Scotland, we have the worst figures in Europe, potentially the world per head of population. We're going to get the next lot of figures out on Friday, and nobody's expecting them to be better. They're expecting them to be worse. I mean, where do you begin, eh? Housing, education, we need treatment facilities, we need harm reduction, we need safe consumption rooms. We need the mental health and addiction services to be joined up. The waiting list for mental health services right now are 2 years in Scotland. If someone presents for treatment, they can't get help the same day. If someone gets initiated for treatment, that usually takes 3 weeks. Sort of assessment takes 3 weeks, and then the initiation takes another 18 weeks on average, and that's what the data is showing. We are so far behind treating this problem, and we've only just started to hear terms like trauma informed, so it's in its infancy as well. So yeah. I feel like we've got a hell of a long, long way to go before we're tooled up for this.
Everyone's talking about class all of a sudden, I find. So let's jump on that bandwagon. How do you describe yourself class-wise?
Working class.
You're from a scheme with all that entails. What are your, you're an author now and you're a professional. What are your experiences transitioning into a more middle-class lifestyle?
Like, similar to survivor's guilt, because I've just bought a house. I live in a strange, right? Because I love where I came from. For all its flaws, I love where I came from. I go back to Ladywell often and feel like I'm coming home. Yeah, I want to provide my kids a different upbringing to parts of my upbringing, and it makes me feel like a fraud and a hypocrite. And it's strange. It's a strange paradox to be in. But I guess I'm striving to make a difference in the world so that people in working class areas have equal opportunities, regardless of what else is out there for people from middle class and other areas. Like, for example, I'm in the, and you'll, I guess, have lots of experience of this too, being in the artistic industry. It's not really an open arms industry for working class folk. Yet, I would argue that some working class folk bring some of the best contributions to that industry.
Absolutely. I mean, the smartest people talking about class these days are from the rap world. You know, people, I'm thinking of like Akala and Darren McGarvey.
Akala is, I love him and Darren McGarvey, both of them.
These are great minds talking about things incredibly eloquently. I think it shows the value of lived experience, actually. People who are living through a given issue, they're often the last people to be asked about it. How has your life experience informed your work?
My life, and I mean this without sounding cliche, my life experience is the biggest asset and qualification that I've got. For example, I went on to study criminology and sociology because of my life experience. I'm just finishing a master's degree in social work because of my life experience. Everything I'm doing stems from where I came from. I'm in the early stages of doing some local community-based projects, and it's all back in my community where I grew up. Life experience is invaluable. It's about, do we provide opportunities for people to turn it into an asset? Because in the past, that life experience was the detriment of my life. But now it's the very thing that has become the biggest asset to everything I'm doing.
One of the step changes in terms of how we can help people in difficult circumstances is to value that lived experience way more than we do currently. I mean, I think there is a change in that, actually, especially in terms of sort of mental health support work. One of the things I think that we didn't have growing up, maybe, that is around now as well, is peer support and people who have lived experience coming back to the environments that they grew up in order to help people within those environments. And why that's important, I think, is because those people have a level of understanding, a level of empathy, and possibly most importantly, a level of gravitas within that community. Do you think a positive role model could have intervened with you? And what do you think of schemes like the Violence Reduction Unit, where they use navigators who've maybe done a bit of time to work with lads who are just leaving prison?
I think it's vital. I think it's a very important way forward, because identification is such an important tool for taking away guilt and shame and feeling alone with a problem. I think that's why recovery fellowships can have success, because you identify with someone else's journey. If I'd have been growing up and there was someone else 10 years older than me or whatever who'd been where I had been and showed both that they'd been there but that they'd turned their life around and went a different way, and you'd be looking to that person to say, how have you done that? Not even just for my generation, like my biological father was in and out of prison, in and out of violence, started off working on the oil rigs and was making good money and was a good looking man and was well built, had all the attributes to be whoever he wanted to be. All the inside stuff destroyed him, and he lived and died as an addict. And his generation, he didn't even talk about addiction or mental health, and men certainly couldn't talk about how they feel. So even that change now is a positive one. But if someone like my biological father had had role models, then it might have ended with him. And he might have been in my life, and his generation might have not have been as socially deprived, and the next generation might have benefited from that. So, like, for example, right now in West Lothian, we've got a whole bunch of artistic movements, from authors to artists to musicians to all sorts of things. And even 10 years ago, there wasn't anything like that. So now younger people growing up in West Lothian are like, oh, you could be something else. And as far as doing it in a way where you're getting like people who used to be in prison and going to prisons, I think stuff like that's very important. It makes me think of a guy called Kevin Neary. I don't know if you know him from
anything. Yeah, I'm aware of him. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So he does similar things. He works now with the police. You know, he used to be an armed robber. And I think that lends credibility to someone who's still in, I don't want to call it the problem, but they're still in that part of their life where they're struggling, or they're, you know, they've made choices they regret and things have happened. If they can see someone else has been where they're at, but is now doing something else, it gives credibility to change, you know.
And a lot of those guys bring an incredible breadth of knowledge to the table, and not just from their own lived experience either. One of the people I find a huge inspiration is a VRU navigator called James Doherty. He's like a sage to me. I could listen to him all day and learn stuff, you know. You broached an interesting point there, which is that I think a lot of the behaviors that we see as innate maybe are very much cultural. The violence, for example, maybe some proof about that is the early rave scene. This is just a bit of a digression, sorry, but like, don't get me wrong, I am not advocating for thousands of people to storm warehouses and take ecstasy. When I was growing up, there was a huge football violence problem or football violence scene. That was the culturally dominant pastime on my estate growing up. And then rave culture hit and that all changed. And all of a sudden, within the space of a year, it was all right for blokes on my estate to hug each other, and people were swapping the terraces for the rave clubs, which sort of proves that these things are cultural and they can be changed. I mean, it didn't last, obviously, and it was problematic and chemically induced often. But my overriding point is that if it can be changed by a youth culture, then surely it can be changed by some other cultural impetus. I wonder how we would go about doing that in a healthier way.
What I'm doing now, we're writing and we're making documentaries, and like I'm writing my second book and doing TV stuff and all that. It's exciting. It's more exciting than the drugs were. And so if there were opportunities for people to do things that excited them and that they were passionate about and that they could wake up in the morning and go, oh, I can't wait to do that, you know, and instead of this idea of zero contract jobs and no future and bouncing around from one situation to the next and not having a lot of options and a lot of choice and a lot of social mobility, if there was an opportunity for people to have a life that fulfilled them, maybe that would be a cultural change. You know, like I'm saying now, there's a lot of people now in West Lothian, where I'm from, looking to do artistic things because it's visible now, because people are like, we have authors, we have bands, we have lots of different people in this area that have used creative methods. Now, that's only one avenue, of course, but that's the example I'm in the middle of right now. I'm part of this creative movement in West Lothian, and it's inspiring other people to take that view as well. So if you're growing up and you're seeing there's a whole bunch of people in my area that are artistically expressing themselves, then you might be drawn to that. But if you're growing up in an area where there's nothing else going on, but everyone's taking heroin or everyone's taking cocaine, then maybe perhaps you'll go in that direction. The next book I'm writing is about the rave scene, but more the dying rave scene, the kind of 2000s when it was kind of at its last hurrah. And the attraction to a lot of the characters was that there was a void, there was nothing else, and that filled the void. And what came with it were the uppers and dysfunctional relationships and, you know, jobs that never lasted. And you kind of lived for your friendships, and you thought you were going to be forever young, and evidently we weren't.
Turns out. You disclose a lot in your book, and somewhere towards the end of the book you were saying that you were only just getting therapy to deal with some of the issues that you faced as a younger person, and that worried me my life is also an open book, and people can be very casual with our trauma once it becomes public property. How are you coping with your trauma being public property, and have you had to deal with any dickheads yet?
This is a strange one, because I'm in the most calm, serene, healthiest place I've ever been. The only negativity I've ever faced is from people that struggle with the positivity, if that makes sense. So it's been a few trolls that, like, for example, I was doing cold water therapy, and someone took it upon themselves to take an exception with me and then slated me on their Facebook page. But they're still in the lad culture mindset, right? So
yeah.
So it's never really been in a response to overexposing myself, as far as what I've shared in my book. It's more been, there's been people that have taken an exception to how good I feel and how positive I feel. But that's very, very rare. Very rare. So I've not had any backlash from oversharing. I think it comes from being in recovery and being used to sharing and having had a lot of therapy. And yeah, I'm actually still waiting to see a psychologist just to deal with some of the final parts of what I was going through. But no, man, I honestly feel totally free. There's nothing weighing me down.
I obviously don't expect you to get into any specifics here. One of the main narrative themes in your book is about being groomed, which I personally have had some experience with as well. And actually, a shocking number of the people that I grew up around have as well. Not so many of the middle-class people I knock around with now have had that experience, although I'm not saying that it doesn't happen. Of course it does. What do you think it is about growing up in a, I never know how to phrase it, disenfranchised environment that makes us so vulnerable?
I mean, I was desperate for love. I was desperate for a father figure. I had a warped view, because not through my own fault, through what this person, the grooming techniques that they used, I had a warped view of that being someone trustworthy and safe and loving and caring. And what I was able to express with this person, what I thought I was, were the things I couldn't express on my scheme, you know? And like, for example, telling the person I was suicidal, and that person, you know, telling them I was crying as I was talking to them, and that person replying that I'm crying as well. You feel like you're bonding with someone, and not realizing as a young person you're being groomed and being taken advantage of. It's only years later, through all this stuff like recovery, therapy, education, you can look back and identify the things they've done to take advantage of you, and you can identify how vulnerable and young that you actually were. And again, it was when the internet first came about, so there was no real knowledge about the dangers of that stuff. It was a brand new phenomena, the internet. So that was, again, against me as well. I mean, obviously, grooming still happens. It's still, grooming and abuse is still relentless. So being aware of it, I don't think, has negated it. But at the time, the lack of knowledge about it just fed into even more the vulnerability and how naive I was. But certainly, what you couldn't get in the schemes was I couldn't tell anyone how I felt. And this person, I thought was a confidant. I thought was someone I could trust, you know.
Such a big part of it is the sort of toxic culture of silence, and the, you know, working class hyper-masculinity. It's a very specific kind of masculinity. In my case, it was somebody with, you know, high status within the sort of criminal community that I was involved in as a younger person. It turned out that everybody knew. And so this guy had a sort of MO of doing this. And despite the classic council estate dogma, you know, you go to any flat top council estate boozer with a angry Rottweiler on the roof, that kind of place, and all you hear about is like, ah, string them up, blah blah blah, you know, and there's all this vocal hyperbole about what people would do, but in reality, people are vulnerable in those situations because of the hierarchy within those cultures, and also how isolated they are, because you know, like, you're not supposed to go to the police for anything. So culturally, we need to sort of protect people and change an ideology that services incredibly dangerous people.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, certainly the culture of, I mean, strip it so far back that you could have issues with anything in that generation and you wouldn't really express your feelings about it.
What have your interactions with mental health services been like over the years? Positives, negatives?
I've never had a lot of interaction with services because there wasn't really many services available, but there were services that I came into contact with, for good and for bad, and I'll explain a couple. One was when I worked for this organisation when I was going through my addiction. It was the same time as my brother had died, and that probably saved me losing my job, right? And I had private healthcare with this organisation, and they sent me a guy from the Priory, a Polish psychologist, and he saved my life. Like, he was one of many people that was intervened in my life at different points and kept me alive, and he was one of the first people that really helped me understand about grief and grieving. You know, we spoke a lot about my little brother's death, and he made me realize I was grieving, and that was part of the problem for what I was going through. And so I'm forever grateful to people like him who helped keep me alive. As far as the downsides, when I tried to kill myself one of the many times, and I know it sounds really blasé when I say that, but I guess I'm just used to talking about it now, but I tried to kill myself in one of my more serious attempts. I ended up by accident in emergency. You see a psychiatrist, and then they send you out this triage team of people that are all linked in, and they come out and see you at your home, and you're supposed to get linked in to mental health services. And then I never heard back for a year and a half. And by the time I heard back, they'd sent it to the wrong address, and it took me, and it was just a whole mix-up. And ultimately, from the point of being suicidal and trying to kill myself to getting help would have been the minimum a year and a half long. And even then, that wasn't, when they tried to contact me, it wasn't to say we've got an appointment for you, it was to say you're now on the waiting list for appointments. So that was detrimental, because what I needed was that night I needed help, and they didn't keep me in or anything either. They just sent me right back out. So it was like an assessment and accident in the accident emergency as well. They had a psychiatrist come and sit and talk to me in the A&E. They didn't take me into a private room or anything. Done their assessment, said they would send people out. The people came out, I think, the following Monday or something. And they'd sent me back into the community again with no real services linked in, no through care, no aftercare, no nothing. And then it was like a waiting list, a year and a half before you get a letter, and then you're on a waiting list. And ultimately, I'm back in the chaos by that point, and I've never got onto the level of getting any support. So there just wasn't anything around. There wasn't. And I've gone for help in my recovery as well, related to mental health. And I remember sitting speaking to a GP and trying to get referred to a service because I'm a student at the time and have a lot of money. And I remember the GP looking at me with wide eyes and saying, "Is this a medical problem?" And I'm like, "Well, you should fucking know." Oops, sorry for swearing. sorry for letting that swear word slip in. But yeah, I was like, you should know that this is a medical problem. And I was looking for a referral, and ultimately I got referred to a third sector organization. And again, it was like 2 years on the waiting list. So they were heavily reliant on these third sector organizations to support all these fragile people in the community, and the waiting lists are extortionate.
Again, sadly, it's an all too common story. Services are overwhelmed. I mean, I've been in mental health services since I was 11, in and out. My first residential stay on a psychiatric ward was in the early 90s, and the walls were nicotine stained, and nobody had their own room. It was always just separated by curtains, so you could hear all the screams throughout the night and stuff, and it looked a bit grim, but it was actually way better. If you have a residential stay in a psychiatric ward now, you probably get your own room, everything's clean. Well, that's all there is. Back then, we had a piano. there was arts therapy. You could sit around the table and talk to staff. Now you can't talk to staff because of the sort of litigiousness. Everything's got to be noted, so you can't have a conversation with anybody. So there are people in residential psychiatric care who don't have a conversation for months and months and months with another human being because they're getting no visitors and staff won't talk to them because they've got to notarize it. And that's like the best case scenario because most people don't get a bed. I despair at the state of mental health services. We're sort of being forced to look after ourselves, which isn't always possible. You are flourishing, obviously, at the moment, which is brilliant to see. Do you have any routines or processes that kind of keep you maintaining, keep you sober, keep you together?
Honestly, it's a mixture of things. Being part of the recovery scene, I still do meetings in the recovery scene. I think I always will now. But I think it's having something that I'm passionate about. So writing and creating is my drug now. You know, that's my drug. And it's more appealing than any other drug ever has been. But you know, it took time to realize that, and to I get a lot of my self-worth now from my creative methods, having family life, having downtime, doing things like going out and doing a hill walk or a Monroe or getting a bit of nature, just a bit of time to switch off from the world. But certainly being involved in the recovery scene has been paramount for me. Getting educated has been paramount for me. Having things to wake up for, you know, having reasons to wake up. If I stop doing the creative stuff, there's going to be a void. And if I don't find something I care about to fill the void, and I don't maintain my mental health through my recovery and stuff, and of course I've done a lot of therapy, then I will navigate back to the unhealthy things, because I've had relapses, and that shows that if I'm not taking care of my mental health and I'm not doing things I care about, I'll feel that hopeless way again and I'll revert back to type.
Isolation and a lack of purpose is a deadly combination, isn't it?
Oh, yeah.
Especially for people with busy brains. Listen, it's been amazing to talk to you. Have you got any projects on the bubble that you want to give a little plug to or have a little chat about?
Yeah, we're doing something called The Chair. First episode is now on my YouTube page, which is Aidan Martin Author. It's also on my Facebook page, same handle. And it's a local documentary where we're taking a Chesterfield chair and we're putting it in the estate and we're getting someone to sit in it and we're just basically hearing their story. The first one's up now. We've got an R3 coming out and we're recording them. It's a local project. I'm meeting the government next week to see about possibly getting funding towards it. Contact Creative Scotland and all they folk. And I'm just about finished my second book, which, as I say, is about the sort of rave, trance, drug scene of the early 2000s in West Lothian, but that'll probably not be out till next year now.
I'm really looking forward to that. I enjoyed the first book, which is Euphoric Recall, by the way. And is there a link to purchase on your Twitter?
Yeah, you can get it from my publisher. It's called Guts Publishing, and you can get it on gutspublishing.com, or you can get it from Amazon or Waterstones, or pretty much Google it and it'll show up all the different places. It's available on paperback, ebook, and audiobook.
All good bookstores, eh?
All good bookstores, that's right.
Thanks so much for talking to me, mate. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you.